Okay, this is on. All right, I have made a few slides because of the porosity of my brain, so if I don't have some order in my discourse, there won't come out anything. Okay, and here is the book. We are basically talking about a little bit about the book that was just published, and we have tomorrow official discussion about the book, and then the how do you say, book party, a little party after, if I recall it right. And it's one of the results of the project that started like 4 years ago. And Jukka will talk more about details and more about concrete things, because I try to give you a thought, sociological, a little bit theoretical introduction to the themes or ideas of the book and ideas of the research. But first I have to find the slides. Yes. All right. So our title is Out of Place, Out of Time, and it's a kind of ironic thing because I came here like 4 years ago, or 5 years ago maybe, and Jukka came like 2 years ago. Here, so we are a little bit. We try to give you a picture from that Martian, a man from Mars, could give you from Northern Karelia, and so it's like. And we are talking about the precarization. So the well, even though if it's not officially accepted to use the term periphery, I will use it to show you that I am a little bit out of place. So one of the first things what the local people working in the local policy institutions that asked from a social researcher, from a sociologist in peripheral areas is to give some kind of decent information or useful information of the society, what is going on in society as a whole, what is the situation in the labor, on the labor markets, how we can teach or educate our people to get better jobs and to create more jobs and so on. And from the students, you quite often hear the things that I want just to educate them that gives me a good possibility to get a job as fast as possible, to give me an optimal education, a good degree, so I can survive on the labor markets. And these are sort of, these are sort of difficult questions or demands for sociologists that's kind of a traditional education, because we are usually not giving any that kind of information, or we are not willing to create jobs for people or something like that. We are not officers of the policy institutions, and the problem is always where to find kind of a niche, kind of a small place to do research in the real scientific terms also, if you speak about sociology. And also the one problem is that when people ask you to have a sort of global view of the local society, they implicitly think that you are kind of a prophet or maybe even a god who can say that what is going on in society. And this is one of the things that we try to avoid in our research also. And so I will start some a little bit history or theory of sociology. It was Gabriel Tardé who defined two grave mistakes or two grave errors in sociology and sociological research. One he named as panorama error. Panorama error is that you go so high up on the mountain and pretend to see everything, whole society as a totality. And this is, of course, one, if we thing about the later history of social research. This is one of the errors that we are used to do when we try to give good information to the local policymaker. And we in the research wanted to avoid this kind of panorama error, going so up and seeing whole society, and that is one of the maybe basic things that I at least think that in some way, somehow we managed to do also in the research. And second error that Tardé named is the history error. And it's kind of an error that you think that the social forms or society is developing in a sort of a evolutionary way, that from one form there develops another form. And indeed, and it stand to society is sort of a disciplinary. It takes perspective on society from the perspective of the discipline of science or sociology or social sciences. And you have to read the history, and you have to take a look at the history of the for the local development, for example. And you see the development of society and social form as some kind of a slowly developing evolution and so on. And this kind of error is typical for academic social research and academic sociological research, and of course also typical to the so-called scientific attitude to social sciences. And this takes the sociology, for example, social research comes from, if it sort of is in this history error, it comes like a history of discipline to which different kinds of events give only some color or something like that. Basic things that from Tardé we learn is that are useful. That is that society is not a totality, it is not a whole, it is composed of heterogeneous elements or forces, if you like the Foucauldian kind of words. And basically the logic of the social or logic of the society's logic is something like he calls innovative adaption or invention. Invention. And so we have two basic things. There is no global view to social problems or society, and it's not possible to study society from the point of view of history and institutions, as I said before. And what remains from Tardian point of view is that is pretty much this, that there is more, as Tardé says, there is more sense in one sentence than in a whole discourse. That is easy to grasp. People make more sense when they say simple sentences than when they start to speak and try to expose their sort of great ideas. And there is more sense or more reason in one single ritual act than in the whole religious doctrine or whole religion. And it means that the logic of the social action or logic of the social has nothing to do with the whole or totality, society as whole, and you can't reduce social facts into kind of organic parts of the whole. What is at stake in Tardé is the production of social facts. How do we product social forms, social facts? I'm using the term social fact because he uses his word so far, but it's not very quite accurate. What is at stake in the production of social facts, for example, in a simple ritual or simple habit? maybe. Firstly, and I have kind of 3 points. Firstly, of course, there is that society is an open field, open space of different and contradictory sentences or rituals. And secondly, logic of the social or logic of the ritual is logic of, as I said, adaption or logic of invention. And thirdly, logic of invention, innovative adaption is basically co-production. We use this term, co-production of sense or co-production of meaning. And there is nothing natural in social facts, as Tade underlines. They are not reactions or responses to external demands, but they are experiments. They are kind of experiments to make world or make space in the world. What we were looking for in the research where this kind of co-production of sense or situation where there happen events where sense is produced together, and also this kind of innovative adaption and production of community and also production of so-called common in local space. These are maybe from Tarde. Then about precarization, some theoretical. The basic idea when we speak in the book or in the research of precarization is that it has basically nothing to do with the atypical jobs or job contracts or work contracts. It's basically behind there is institutional crisis. There's one of the basic institutions of contemporary and modern societies. Wage labor is in crisis, and also wage labor and wage labor relationship as a model for social research is in some way in crisis. But I'll try to explain a little bit later more concretely. Yes, 2 minutes. And wage labor, when it is crisis, it has become a sort of kind of a source of anxiety and instability, and it is not able to keep the stability to life. This was one idea, and so we were searching on new institutions beyond or behind wage labor, and wage labor. And if I point out only few things that, to me, I think are from the basis of basic results and maybe also from the basic orientation of future for the research are as follows. What we did find out is the huge discrepancy or contradiction between local policies and the actual ways people try to make their lives livable or try to adapt to the conditions of precariousness. And this seems to me that in many cases, as we went through the strategies, local strategies and so on, and in many cases, it's the many of the policies adapted in the local level, they don't help people to make their lives livable. They don't help people to adapt their lives and create new social forms. But on the contrary, they sort of try to hinder and so on, because they are keeping so tugging on the idea of wage labor as the only way of living, only way of earning decent living and so on. And the second thing is more theoretical. It's about care work, and then during the process I had to went through some of the feminist literature about care from 1980s, like Carol Gilligan and so on. And I think that I did find out some things that at least help me when I'm doing research on the transformations of labor and work and the transformations of society. There are such things that are from the Tardian perspective you can find if we think of care work as a model for social research or sociological research, as a model also for to research contemporary labor markets and society. There is always innovative adaption. There is co-production that is so important that for those people, for example, who develop new software and so on, you have to involve the client into the production. Or production of services, you have to involve the client in the production of service. And then it's tied to concrete situations. It's not general, abstract, or universal thing. You have to study the concrete situations, not sort of abstract ideas. And then, of course, it resists generalization. That it's a big problem when you think about in terms of what is going on in the care sector and when people are trying to formalize care work and formalize social work and formalize the relational work. And it resists generalization, okay? And then it constructs morality of society from below, not from up. And so if I finish my, it kind of forces us to recognize our sort of dependency and our precariousness of on the situation of our precariousness. And forces us also the kind of social experiments, and in that way, production of society and production of new social forms. And now it's Jukka's turn.
Okay.
This is only. I wanted only to give you some sort of general ideas behind. Maybe part of them are only mine.
Okay. Because in the part of the precarization in North Korea research project, we had these two focus group discussions, and I have some remarks related to the Russian speaking focus group discussions. And maybe more generally also about these Russian immigrants in Finland. And these Estonians and Russians form the largest immigrant groups in Finland, and especially the Russian-speaking immigrants have concentrated in the southern part of Finland, in the large cities, but also in this border region. For example, in North Karelia, of the around 4,000 foreign-speaking inhabitants, more than half are Russian-speaking. And while in the total foreign population, male foreigners outnumber the female ones, in the case of Russian and Estonian, the women comprise a majority. And this increasing significance of Russia and Russian-speaking immigrants in North Karelia is also highlighted in the North Karelia strategies. This cross-border cooperation is regarded as one of the main opportunities for the development and economic growth of the region. And there's sort of ambitious aim that North Karelia would become the center of leading expertise of Russia in Finland. So according to these strategies, Russia is the Trump card of North Karelia, and it's the Russian-speaking immigrants who have a strategic role in the development of the region as a link between Russian and Finnish cultures. But because the limited time I have only two points I want to highlight regarding this Russian-speaking focus group discussion. The first point is the problem of governmental categorization of immigration and autonomy of migration, and the second one is the role of immigration administration in producing hierarchization of labor. So the Russian as non-EU citizens who are immigrating to Finland have to apply for a residence permit either on the basis of work, education, or marriage. But since the beginning of 1990s, persons with Finnish ancestry or some other close connection with Finland have been able to get a residence permit. And these returnees are mainly Ingrian Finns who have lived in the Karelia and part of the territory which were transferred to Russia after the Second World War. But this returnee program forms an exception in otherwise strict immigration policy, and around 30,000 returnees have moved to Finland. And the woman who participated in the focus group discussion has mainly come to Finland because of marriage or through this returnee program. But immigration is usually conceptualized and examined from the perspective of the state, which means immigrants are classified based on the reason of immigration and related ground for residence permit. But in this residence permit process, the multiple life situation of immigrants are reduced to one reason, which either entitles or doesn't entitle to a residence permit. However, these categories like returnee or labor migrant doesn't tell necessarily anything about the situation of the migrants or their reasons to move, which always exceed simple categorization. And I think this was very obvious in these discussions. Like, to take an example, there were two of the women who had a like workplace when they moved, but neither of them came sort of as a labor-based immigrants, meaning like to the work permit process, but because of the marriage and a returnee status. And also one of them applied for a study place in Finland, but he explained that she wanted to move to Finland because of her mother, who had got married with a Finnish man. But when she was moving to Finland, she was already over 18 years old and thus not entitled to a residence permit because of the family ties. So to find a way to live with her mother, she had to apply for a study place. So it's, important to regard this categorization as a part of government of migration, as a construction that allows states to govern migration in a particular way. Individual motives and motivation for migration are irrelevant for the construction of these categories or figures, as for example Enrica Riiko and Serhat Karkojali have argued. So this residence permit system forms a sort of mold or frame which produces different possibilities for immigration for different persons. But at the same time, it produces different positions for immigrants in the new country and hierarchization among them. So the border functions as sort of a difference machines. So even though the motives for immigration would be quite similar, immigrants can be in totally different juridical position because of the category of residence permit and respective rights. And there's a good example of this was the two of the women who moved to Finland because of marriage in the 1990s. So the one was married with a Finnish man, and she got the A status, but the one who was married with a Russian man and moved because her husband workplace in Finland, she got the B status, which means that she was not entitled to participate in any integration services and was not even allowed to work for 6 years in Finland. Whereas the one who was married with a Finn, she was entitled to all services and had an automatic right to work. So from the governmental perspective, some foreign citizen seems to be more foreign than others. So I think it's important to highlight these different legal statuses, not because they would explain the multiple situation of immigrants, but because they produce different legal positions and different possibilities for creating a life in the new country. So, like, and from the methodological point of view, it means that it's impossible to understand migration on the level of of this categorization of migration. Scholars like Dimitris Papadopoulos and Sandro Metsadra have used the term autonomy of migration to emphasize the autonomous character of migratory movements. The autonomy of migration means that a different perspective is required to examine contemporary migration, a perspective which takes into account the multiple experiences, aspiration, and motivation of people who move and settle into a new country. This, of course, doesn't mean ignoring the structural and economic circumstances which form the channels for migrants to cross borders and settle in a new country. So, in order to understand immigration and migratory movements, we need research which starts from the border, from the practices of and experiences of migrants and their material situation, and experiences of movement, settlement, work, belonging, etc. This is something we had tried to do also in this precarization in North Karelia project. Do I have time for the second point?
Yes, you have.
Okay, good. So it's the second point is related to the labor issue, and it's also a bit what Soile already talked about. So the Russian-speaking immigrants are generally well-educated, and most of the women in the focus group had also university degrees made in Russia, like in medicine, law, English, Finnish, chemistry, economics, and history. And some had vocational education as a secretary and as a midwife. So, but even though they were well-educated and had previous working experience, immigration often means starting from a zero, as it was repeated in discussions many times. Like, I had to start life from a zero, and so I started it from a zero. So this starting from a zero refers to the problem to continue one's professional career. So, of course, the labor market situation in North Karelia and also the employers' attitudes affect the immigrants' possibilities of employment. But there's another problem, which is the recognition of education. Because in Finland, access to many professions is regulated through the educational qualification. And in some cases, there is supplemental education available for immigrants in order to have one's education recognized. But in general, this devaluation of education is also recognized by authorities as a considerable problem, especially in the case of Russian immigrants. But this devaluation of education is not simple like a human capital mismatch, and not necessarily related to the equivalence of education between like the Russian and Finnish system, but it's also due to the protection of national labor markets. And this could be also seen in the discussion collected in the project, because there's a good example of the two women who had a degree in healthcare. One was a doctor and one was a midwife. But only the doctor's degree was recognized as a valid degree, but for the midwife, the authorities said they propose her a re-education as an assistant nurse. But there's a lack of doctors in these peripheral areas, like North Karelia, and the doctors are already recruited from Russia. And because of the aging population and the low status of feminized care work, there's also an increasing need for assistant nurses, and immigrant women are seen as a sort of solution to the labor shortages in the care sectors. And the officials have advised women to study care work As it was concluded in the discussions, this is a quote, some assistant nurse, they advised it for everybody. So regardless of the immigrant's education, the administration seems to recognize Russian-speaking immigrant women as a woman suitable for care work. But however, this care work wasn't very tempting option for the woman in the focus group, and only one had studied and worked as an assistant nurse. And also in her case, it was because it was basically the only option in a small municipality. Well, but then the interesting question is that what is left when the education or the human capital loses its value? In a paradoxical way, the command of Russian language was the most important resource in employment, regardless of the education, in this focus group discussions. And it's this cross-border interaction have created employment opportunities for Russian-speaking persons in the business sector and especially in the customer service in North Karelia. So the women participated in the discussions have worked, for example, as waitresses, salespersons, and hotel receptionists like Larissa. And also in the case of Larissa, it was the command of Russian language, because there was, which helped her to get employed, because there's a lot of Russian-speaking customers and they wanted to have service in Russian language. But the second, and this translation work was also a very common work which the women had done either by firms in cross-border business or as trainees in the public sector or as freelance translators. And it's maybe important to highlight that the language skills, okay, it makes possible to get employed, but it makes also possible to refuse to do jobs they didn't find tempting, like care work. I can stop here if you, Oh.
So
No, I can stop here.
Okay, thank you.